Good evening. We are in class number 3 of this module. I wanted to invite you guys on October 10th, which is our second to last class. If everybody wants to stay after, we're going to have some tea and cookies just to give you guys a chance to, you know, hang out a little bit, talk a little bit. We can, you know, if Robbie's going to test us on the last week, we can review things, talk about questions we have, just to kind of like give a little bit more opportunity for that. So that'll be October 10th. And then our last class will be on October 17th. As you know, because I keep saying it, we do not charge for our classes. The idea is we don't want to create an obstacle for you to come in and learn and see what this is all about. And today I was thinking, like, 2,000 years ago, stories of Shakyamuni Buddha traveling around in the wilderness, teaching monks, and, you know, this is before monasteries. Everybody was kind of nomadic. And I just kind of felt like it was a cool connection. It just made me kind of feel like a sense of this just kind of giving freely of the Dharma. So I feel like it's kind of a connection to that spirit. It's also an opportunity for us to develop generosity so that if I make a donation, I can make a donation as a gift from my heart, kind of strengthen the community and things like that, not out of some kind of obligation or someone's telling you what this is worth and you have to do it. But for people like me, we're still kind of developing that aspiration to have that true sense of generosity where I'm just giving for the sake of all beings. I'm still working on things where I just go, okay, maybe this is a value of something and I give like that, and that's totally okay too. So if any of those things speak to you, we have lots of ways to donate. They're not very complicated. It's a box. It's giving online, things like that. So that's my thoughts on that for today. Any questions about logistics, handouts, things like that? Okay, Robbie's going to come in a minute then.
Testing, okay. Good evening, everyone. Welcome to the third class in the Discovering Buddhism module, Mind and Its Potential. I'm Robbie Watkins. I'm the course leader. Let's see. Do we have some people who are here for the first time tonight? Hands a little higher. Okay, great. Glad to have you here. We've covered some material already, but I think you'll get something of value from the evening. Have you two been to Kadampa Center before? First time here? Okay, great. We're going to start with some prayers. So if everybody can get a copy of the gold prayer book. And turn to page 35, the daily prayers. It said that reciting prayers are like tilling the ground before we plant the seeds. If we just start in on our meditation and study, our mind is like hard, untilled dirt, and nothing can take root. But the prayers help soften our mind and our heart so that we can get more benefit from what's to follow. And last time we talked about taking refuge and generating bodhicitta, the first prayer. Refuge means developing a sense that things are not going the way we want to in our life, and we've found something we can turn to, in this case being the Buddha, the Dharma, the teachings of the Buddha, and the Supreme Assembly, or those who have followed the path of the Buddha. And bodhicitta is the great mind, the mind that at every moment is motivated by the wish to become enlightened for the benefit of all sentient beings, all feeling or all conscious beings, a mind state that's not natural to most of us, but which we try to generate with, even if it takes some effort. So we went through that prayer last time, and tonight we'll read that three times, then we'll read the four immeasurables, the seven limb prayer, and then we'll do the mandala offering. The four immeasurables, these immeasurable refers to immeasurably great wishes or aspirations. The first one is, may all sentient beings have happiness and the causes of happiness. That's the Buddhist definition of, anybody know what that is?
Love.
That's love, according to the Buddhist dictionary. The wish that others be happy, whether I'm around or not. It's not happy being with me and doing what I want to do, but the genuine wish that someone be happy. So that's expressing immeasurable love, not just for my family and friends, not just for the people I like, but for everyone. And then we say, may all sentient beings be free from suffering and the causes of suffering. What's that?
Compassion.
That's the Buddhist definition of compassion, the wish that others be free of suffering. So there's a little bit of distinction. Love and compassion are not exactly the same thing. Love, the wish that they be happy. Compassion, the wish that they be free of suffering. And we say, may all sentient beings be inseparable from the happiness that is free from suffering. That really refers to joy. And then, may all sentient beings abide in equanimity, free from attachment for friends and hatred for enemies. So this is a state of seeing, may everybody be in a state where they see everyone as equally valuable, as equally meaningful, not holding close, not clinging to our friends and hating our enemies, but seeing everyone as wishing to be happy, the state of immeasurable equanimity. So those are the four immeasurables. As you can see, we're not saying, dear Buddha, please make all sentient beings happy. We're expressing the wish, may all sentient beings be happy. We're generating the mind within ourselves that wishes that that would be true. It's an, as Geshe Gelug says, it's an aspiration. We're not praying to an all-powerful, all-knowing being, and a creator God. There is no creator God in Buddhism. So that's a brief explanation of the four immeasurables. So we'll recite that. Then we'll recite the seven limb prayer, and I'll explain that at the next class. And then we'll do our mandala offering, in which we imagine all the wonderful things in the universe in the form of a mandala, or a perfect world, that we're offering it to all living beings. We're just imagining everything great and wonderful that we can think of, and we imagine that we're freely and spontaneously, without any regret, offering it to others. And as we worked on last week, that's accompanied, if you want to give it a try, by the hand mudra. These hand gestures are called mudras. That represents the universe, with Mount Meru supposedly in the center and the four continents around, representing the entire universe. Yeah. Okay. Get your hands out. Ring fingers pointing up together. Okay, yeah. Back to back on the ring fingers. Then you cross your two middle fingers, and you put your index finger over the tips of the middle fingers, pull them down.
What?
You got to get your index fingers pointing up first, okay? First thing, get your index fingers pointing up. Stop touching. Just those two. Start with just those two. Then you cross the middle fingers. Yeah, that's good. Yeah, yeah. Pull you across them more. Yeah. Uh huh. Then you pull the tips down with your index fingers. Yeah, yeah. Other side. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, that's it. Yeah. Now the other one. No, back a finger. Yeah, back one more. Back on the back side. Yeah, and pull those down. That's good. Then you cross the little fingers. and pull those down with your thumbs. Yeah. Maybe you should have a whole class on this.
That doesn't look great.
Yeah, the whole point is it's what your motivation that counts. We'll put it that way. Okay. And then we would dissolve it by bringing it to us and go back to the hands touch. Okay. So don't get hung up on the mudra. That's not the important thing. Okay, so we'll recite our prayers, beginning with refuge and bodhicitta three times. Our hands together at the level of our heart, with our thumbs and touching inside, said to represent the wisdom, union of wisdom and compassion that is enlightenment. I go for refuge until I'm enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By my practice of giving and other perfections, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I'm enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By my practice of giving and other perfections, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I'm enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By my practice of giving and other perfections, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. May all sentient beings have happiness and the causes of happiness. May all sentient beings be free from suffering and the causes of suffering. May all sentient beings be inseparable from the happiness that is free from suffering. May all sentient beings abide in equanimity, free from attachment for friends and hatred for enemies. Reverently I prostrate with my body, speech, and mind. I present clouds of every type of offering, actual and imagined. I declare all my negative actions accumulated since beginningless time, and rejoice in the merit of all holy and ordinary beings. Please remain until the end of cyclic existence and turn the wheel of Dharma for living beings. I dedicate my own merits and those of all others to the great enlightenment. Now we do the mandala offering with the mudra, if you like. This ground, anointed with perfume, strewn with flowers, adorned with Mount Meru, four continents, the sun, and the moon. I imagine this as a Buddha field and offer it. May all living beings enjoy this pure land. Idam Guru Ratnam Mandalakam Niryatayami. Okay, so we'll go through the seven limb prayer next time and explain that a little bit. So we've done our prayers. Our mind is a little bit softened, more receptive to what's to follow. So we'll do our first meditation session. Let's see, where's my bell? We begin by checking our posture. The most important aspect of the posture is the back is a little bit straighter than we normally sit. Not rigid, but a little bit stretched. A little bit straighter than we normally sit. Our head is straight on our shoulders, maybe a degree or two in front of the vertical, but not with our chin down on our chest and not tilted to one side or the other. Our eyes are either just slightly open, letting in a little bit of light, or lightly closed, but not clenched, tightly closed. Our mouth is closed, and again, the jaw is relaxed. Our tongue is on the gums above the back side of our upper teeth. Our shoulders are down. a little bit back, not caved forward, but a little back, so our chest is open. Our upper arms are away from our torso, so that there's a nice movement of air through there. And we can either put our hands on our knees, or have right hand and left with our thumbs touching, slightly below the level of our navel. If we're on a cushion, we're sitting on the front third of the cushion so that we're not back, but we're forward and our pelvis is open. If we're sitting in our chair, our feet are flat on the floor. If we like to put a cushion under our feet, that's fine, but we're not slumped back. Our back stays straight. And for those of us on the cushion again, your legs are in a position that you feel comfortable and relaxed with. And the whole point of the posture is not that it's uncomfortable, but it says very stable. And once established, we can basically ignore it so that we don't have to worry about it during our meditation. We feel rooted, very solid and grounded. So take a moment and working from the top of your head down, identify any sources of tension or discomfort. Shake those out, wiggle around, adjust your posture so that you don't have to deal with them as distractions during the meditation that's to follow. And now that we've established our posture, we're going to begin with a very simple version of what's referred to as a 9-round breathing. And there are many different versions and different ways of doing this. And this is just one. But this again helps settle the mind. And these will be deep breaths with our stomach expanding on the in-breath. So our diaphragm is being pulled down and our lungs are completely filled, and then the stomach contracting towards the spine on the out-breath. So we begin by taking our right index finger, closing our left nostril, and doing 3 breaths in and out through the right nostril, deep breaths. Then we take the right index finger, close our right nostril, do 3 breaths in and out through the left nostril. And then we do 3 breaths in and out through both nostrils. And after you complete the 9 rounds, you just allow your breathing to return to its normal pattern. You don't want to stay with that really deep breathing because you can get a little bit lightheaded if you do it too long. Now we allow our breathing to return to its normal pattern. And we begin our meditation by setting our motivation. And the motivation that we've chosen is the bodhicitta motivation, the wish to become enlightened for the benefit of others. So that we think that we are doing this meditation to develop our mind in ways that will ultimately benefit all living beings. Even something as simple as just doing a few minutes of meditation, it's done with that purpose. And having begun, set our motivation, we now begin the actual meditation, which is a simple breathing meditation. We just place our consciousness, our awareness, on the physical sensation of the breath moving in and out through the openings of our nostrils. Nothing more, nothing less than that. Mind aware of breath. Not describing it or picturing it or even counting the breath, but just direct perception of air moving in and out through the nostrils. And inevitably, our mind wanders away from the breath, away from the object of concentration. And when we become aware of that, we gently let go of that shiny new object, whatever it is, and come back to the breath, over and over and over again. Not being harsh with ourselves, not criticizing ourselves, but just gently dropping the distraction and coming back to the breath over and over and over again. And we can end our meditation session with a brief dedication. We acknowledge that sitting quietly like this, we made a positive imprint on our mind stream. And we think, may that positive imprint not be wasted, but may it ripen in the future in a way that benefits all living beings. Any question about the prayers or about the meditation practice? Yeah, let's see. We got a mic. Hold on. Thank you.
So while I'm doing the meditation and trying to remain focused on my breath, I'll have thoughts that...
Is the mic on?
It's on.
Okay, hold it a little bit closer.
I'll have thoughts that pop in and are sort of automatically terminated before they begin to be a full-fledged thought.
Mm-hmm.
Should I let those ripen and then dismiss them, or
if you're aware of them, just let them go then. Yeah,
okay.
Don't get some of them do ripen, and we get very caught up in them. But just say thought, or just think, okay, let that go. Not going to go down that path. Okay. Anyone else? Okay. So this class is the mind and its potential. Mainly we're trying to understand what the mind is from the Buddhist point of view. As Buddhism is frequently referred to as a mind science, everything in Buddhism is about its effect on our mind. That's where the action is. Even though it may be accompanied by a lot of ritual and colors and noise and incense and everything, it's all about working with our mind. So the first module in discovering Buddhism is trying to understand what our mind is. And like I say, if you remember nothing from this class, I hope you remember the four characteristics of mind as defined by the Buddha. So I'm going to drill them into your head one more time. First one is
non-physical.
The mind is completely non-physical. It's that non-physical aspect of our being. It's connected to the brain, it's related to the brain, but it is not the brain. And when we use the word mind, we can use that interchangeably with consciousness or awareness. But it's that non-physical aspect of our being that we're so intimately familiar with that it's sometimes hard to pull back and even look at it. But it is not the body. It is the non-physical aspect that makes up who, that goes with the body to makes up who we are. Second characteristic, quality. A little louder, please.
Without beginning, without an end.
Yes, no beginning and no end. Okay, it means that my mind, my consciousness, can always be traced back to a previous moment of consciousness, to a previous moment, to a previous moment in this lifetime, and according to the teachings of the Buddha, in previous lifetimes. This consciousness was joined with countless different bodies, different physical forms, in countless previous lifetimes. And you cannot find a moment where my consciousness came into being. You can't find a moment where There was no consciousness, and then my consciousness arose. Okay, the Buddha said that there's no such thing. Consciousness, a moment of consciousness, is always preceded by a previous moment of consciousness, by a previous moment of consciousness, by a previous moment of consciousness. According to the Buddha, non-physical phenomena have to come from non-physical precedents. And a physical phenomena has to come from physical precedents. So that our body comes from the union of the sperm and the egg, from our parents. And their parents came from the previous union of sperm and egg of their parents. So on back and back, and you can trace that back. But the consciousness that joins with that embryo in the womb is comes only from previous moments of consciousness, and there is no beginning. And the same way, it will continue in the future. When I, Robbie, dies, the Buddhist point of view, that means that the mind and body separate, the body ultimately decays, the consciousness continues, there's no end of consciousness, it's not Robbie's personality as we talked about last time, but Robbie's very subtle consciousness that continues on carrying its karmic imprints goes into the bardo, this intermediate state, where it has visions of different rebirths and according to the various karma that's ripening, picks its next rebirth or is forced into its next rebirth. There's really no choice. And the consciousness joins up with the body in a future life. And that also will continue without end. Hopefully that consciousness will become enlightened, will reach the state of Buddhahood, the state of complete wisdom and compassion. But it doesn't mean the consciousness does not cease at that point. The consciousness still continues, even after it becomes enlightened. There's no beginning and there's no end. And then as we also talked about, that implies that there are no new consciousnesses being created and no consciousnesses going out of existence. Okay, the number of consciousnesses is infinite but unchanging, if you can say that. Because we move throughout different realms. We're not always in a human rebirth, and this is not the subject of this class, but we're moving in and out of different realms. So the number of consciousnesses in the human realm will be changing, but the total number of consciousnesses is not changing. Okay? Third characteristic. Yeah, its nature is like clear light. And say like empty space. And that it has no fixed characteristics in the way that we tend to think, I am an angry person, or I am a depressed person, or I am a generous person. The Buddhist point of view is, you may have a lot of generous thoughts that arise in this empty space that is your consciousness. You may have a lot of depressed thoughts that arise in that space, but the mind itself is not that quality or characteristic. That's just a phenomena that's occurring in the empty space of the mind. So the implication is that the mind is infinitely changeable based on the thoughts that arise within that space. And most of our thoughts, as we start to notice when we're in meditation, seem to be completely random or chaotic or haphazard. They're actually the results of previous karma. Nothing's happening for no reason. All the minutia that comes up when we're sitting in a meditation like that is the result of past karma. So if we want to have happy, non-suffering thoughts, loving, kind, wise thoughts, we have to create the karma that causes those thoughts. If we want to be angry and depressed, we create the karma that causes angry, depressed thoughts. The Buddha says it's your choice. But you can develop the ability to control the thoughts that arise in that empty space that is your mind. So this is the mind has no fixed qualities, That's why each of us has the ability to become enlightened. If our mind had fixed qualities, if it was limited, if it was constrained within certain boundaries, enlightenment would be an impossibility. But the fact that the mind is essentially an empty space, that's what makes becoming a Buddha a possibility for each of us. And the fourth one is... louder?
Awareness.
Its function is to be aware. Yeah. It perceives, okay? And I brought up the image last time of a mirror, and I think that's a very good one, like a perfect mirror that has nothing fixed in what it reflects, but it reflects whatever is placed in front of us. But it has no, it's not like a painting, which just is one way, okay? The mind is like a mirror that perfectly reflects the thoughts that are within its empty space. Angry thoughts, you have a mirror that's reflecting anger continuously. Happy thoughts, you have a mirror that's reflecting happiness. But the mirror, those qualities are not part of the mirror. That's what the mirror reflects. And it can reflect anything that we put in front of it. So the same way the mind perceives whatever it interacts with, whatever it is aware of, okay? It perceives, and there's just mind perceiving angry thought, mind perceiving happy thought, mind perceiving red cushion, mind perceiving glass of water, mind perceiving breath moving in and out. That's what the mind does. It perceives. Nothing more, nothing less than that. Okay? Any questions about those or comments? Okay, Mike, up back here, please.
So, is it like focus? Like what you focus on is the same as what you're aware of?
Similar, okay. Getting in, and these are things we have to kind of work around, but it's getting there. Focus implies that we have kind of a choice, and a lot of what our mind perceives, we don't have a choice. You know, it's coming up automatically because of our karma. Okay, focus means kind of we're choosing to put our attention on that,
right,
which is what we're practicing in meditation. Okay, developing some control over our mind that most of us notice when we sit in the cushion is pretty uncontrolled. So we'd like to develop more focus. That's a quality that we can develop.
So awareness is just like you're in a movie and you're watching a movie.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly. A movie screen with the projector. And when we start off, we have no control over what's being projected on the screen. No choice. We don't get to pick what the movie is. But as we develop our minds, we can start to influence the movie, you know, give it a little bit of a happy ending, choose, run a different movie completely. That's a better image. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
That's a good one.
Thanks.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Any other questions or comments? Okay. See, can you get me something to erase with? Yeah. Or the class is over. If I'm stuck with this. Does intellect affect any of it?
Yeah.
In what sort of way? What does that mean?
In awareness, if you're having angry thoughts and you realize you need to tone those thoughts down,
mm-hmm.
Does intellect play a part in that?
Well, I mean, you have to have a mind that's functioning. You know, you have to have the good karma to be born with a mind that can think clearly to make much progress on the path. But book smarts in terms of IQ is not necessarily a prerequisite for becoming enlightened, I don't think.
Okay.
Okay. Yeah. Okay, so one of the fundamental questions that everybody asks is, who am I or what am I? And according to the Buddhist point of view, which you don't have to accept, this is just what I look at, the simplest way to say who I am is I'm a body. I just talked about this. And a mind that come together temporarily. The body and mind join at the moment of conception. They separate at the moment of death. And the temporary, impermanent, ever-changing union of this body and this mind or consciousness is labeled, or sometimes you'll hear the phrase, merely labeled, as Robbie. Okay. Robbie, in the way that we think of him, is not a solid existing thing, but is a label, is merely a label, as Lama Zopa says over and over, which means nothing more than, is only a label that we put on this temporary union of this body and this mind. There's no inherent Robbie that can be found either in the body or in the mind or in the union of the two, in the collection of the two. Robbie or I or me is just a label placed on the temporary coming together of this body and mind. So impermanent, ever-changing. That's the base, that in the simplest form, that's what Buddhism says who Ravi is. He's just a label placed on a body and a mind that are coming together short term. There's a book by, I think it's Daniel Goleman, called Thoughts Without a Thinker. Okay? I am having thoughts, and I am having a body, but there, you can't find any real Robbie that those thoughts belong to. Okay? Thoughts without a thinker. Just a series of thoughts occurring in the consciousness with a body. We just label that Robbie, but there's no Robbie that these actually belong to that can be found anywhere. We'll talk about this a lot more in the class in emptiness, which is towards the end of the Discovering Buddhism series. So this is a very basic model. We can expand on it a little bit more. I mean, body, there's not much we can say about that. I mean, body is body. It's purely physical. There's not much more we can say about that. It's the purely physical aspect of our being. But a more complex explanation of this, which is not saying this is wrong, but just detail a little bit more, is what's referred to as the five aggregates. And you'll hear a reference to this lots of times. Also, the Sanskrit word for aggregate is skandhas. S-K-A-N-D-H-A-S. And this model says that we can look at our existence and we can find five different components. We can break it down a little bit more. The first is referred to as, in this model, as form. Which is just the physical body again. The second aggregate is referred to as feelings. And all these are is the feeling of liking something, not liking something, or being indifferent. And these, if we look closely at our mind, we'll see that everything that we perceive, everything that we're aware of, one of those feelings is attached to it. It may be very strong. I mean, the smell of something disgusting, we don't like that. The taste of chocolate cake, the feeling of liking that is very strong. The thought of someone on the other side of the world walking down the street, complete indifference. Okay? Very basic things. I mean, if we look at all our rationalizations and our justifications, they can all be reduced down to, I like it, I don't like it, or I don't care. It's pretty disgusting. I mean, it's really, we're functioning at a pretty infantile level with just about everything we come into. I like it, I want more of it. I don't like it, I want less of it, or I don't care. Okay? And these feelings arise automatically with everything we come into contact to. I mean, we just looking at this red cushion, there is, if we look at our mind closely enough, one of those feelings identified with just perceiving the cushion. It may be very subtle. We may not be aware of it, but it arises. And where do those feelings come from? Do they come from the cushion out there? Does everybody who looks at that cushion have a feeling of, that's an ugly color of maroon, it doesn't match the other one, I don't like it? How many people have that feeling? A couple? How many people have a feeling, I don't care? How many people have a feeling, I really like it? Okay. So, the feeling is not coming from the cushion, because there are different feelings from it, okay? Everybody in this room has different feelings or a different degree of those feelings. Where is that feeling coming from? Why don't I like that cushion?
Comes from karma.
Comes from karma, exactly. Okay, these feelings that we have no control over, that arise automatically with every perception we have, not just physical objects, not just people, but ideas, memories, dreams, plans, everything has a feeling attached to it, and that's the result of our past karma. Okay, our actions of body, speech, and mind in the past have made imprints on our mind stream that ripen in those feelings. Okay? So that we really have no control over our feelings at this point. We sometimes refer to them as instinct. You know, I like blue. Well, that's determined by karma, according to the Buddha. It's not just random. There is some sort of karma I've created in the past that causes a pleasant feeling to arise when I see the color blue. Okay? So that's the second aggregate. The third aggregate is perception. And that is the mental ability to distinguish what is dark maroon cushion from everything else that is not dark maroon cushion. Okay? If I didn't have this ability, everything would look the same. Okay, it's the ability to distinguish one phenomena from what it's not, from what is not that phenomena. Okay? The thing that I can look and see, that is Aaron, everything else is appearing to me is not Aaron. Okay, it's what allows us to recognize, to perceive, to put a label on. And that's referred to in this model as perception. The fourth aggregate is referred to as mental formations. And this is whatever our mind does after feelings and perceptions. Okay, after we perceive cushion, I have that unpleasant feeling. Then I start making plans to avoid that cushion or not to sit on that cushion or not to look at that cushion when I come to the Gompa. Planning never to buy a cushion that color, to wonder who bought that cushion, I don't like that. Everything that follows upon that is referred to as mental formation. Okay, this is how we take the perceptions and feelings and start to act on them, either mentally or we say something, I do not like that cushion, or we act physically on it. I take the cushion, I have the volition, the mental formation to pick it up and to take it and throw it outside. Okay? And then in the five aggregates model, the last aggregate is consciousness, which is, again, just awareness, okay? It's the space in which these other three previous ones occur. So this is really body, and these four are mind. So this is just describing things in a little bit more detail. Okay, but it's still basically saying we're made up of body and mind. And if we look at the mind a little bit more closely, we'll see that there are feelings, which we have no control over. There are perceptions. We can distinguish one object from another. We have mental formations that we form upon the basis of our feelings and perceptions. And there's consciousness, the space in which these actions occur. So that's the five aggregates, or the five skandhas. Again, said I, Robbie, I'm a temporary coming together of these five aggregates. It's an aggregation. I am an aggregation of these five components. You can't find Robbie in any one of these. If you take the body, if you had just my body with no mind, I don't think most of us would say that was Robbie. We'd say that was Robbie's body, implying that there's a Robbie that body belonged to, but we'd understand that there's not Robbie in just the body. And if we look at each of these other aggregates, it'd be hard-pressed to say that one of those is Robbie also. So again, Robbie is just a label that's applied to these five aggregates, the aggregation of these five factors, which is temporary, and we merely label Robbie onto that. Okay, let's see, we've got a comment.
From the Buddhist point of view, do they believe in the soul?
No, that's a good question. No, they believe in no soul.
Okay.
Yeah, they're saying the soul is generally perceived to be something permanent to us, some permanent aspect, and Buddhism says there is no, by permanent I mean unchanging, our root self. And Buddha's saying, no, you can look and look, you cannot find a soul. Okay, there is no soul. Yeah, in the same way that there's no God. There's nothing permanent or unchanging. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. From what I understand from what you've been saying, the mind is clear light, right?
Mm-hmm.
But it seems like feelings and perception and mental formation aren't reflective of that. Would those be more processes of the brain and less so processes of the mind?
Well, they occur in the space of the mind. And were you here last week? Okay, we talked about there are three levels of consciousness. There's a gross level or of mind, a subtle level, a very subtle level. The gross level is very full of thoughts, feelings, emotions. It's like dirt that's in water. Okay, the dirt is not inherently part of the water, but that's where it is. You can sift out, get the dirt out eventually, and you're left with clear water, and that's the mind. But, or again, the images of clouds passing through a clear sky. Those are the thoughts and the emotions. Those are in the gross consciousness, but they're not part of the clear light mind. Okay? Any other comments or questions? Yeah.
Can the body and mind, can the mind separate from the body without causing death or partially or completely?
Hmm. That's a good question for a Geshe. Yeah. You hear these stories of the Buddha, the mind of a Buddha is all said to be all-pervasive. Okay, it's not all-powerful, but it can be everywhere. So that implies that it is separate from a physical body. I think, the consciousness of a Buddha chooses if it's going to take on a physical body. So it can exist as pure consciousness when you reach that stage. For most of us, though, we're in samsara, where rebirth is something we don't choose, but is just forced on us by our karma. So I think at very high levels, you could say it can that way. Okay. Back here one more time.
If consciousness is clear light and it cannot be
it doesn't have a beginning, it doesn't have an end, it cannot be created.
It's created from a previous moment of consciousness.
Or talking more about the most subtle mind, the clear light,
yeah.
The one that continues.
Mm-hmm.
And so if there's always one light and it's always one light,
mm-hmm.
Why is there more people in the world
yeah.
compared to...
That's because there are other realms, okay? For one thing, there's animal realms. The consciousness can join with the body of an animal, or the consciousness can join with the body in these other realms that we're not aware of. The hell realms, the hungry ghost realms, the demigod realms, the god realms, these realms that we don't see, but our consciousness has been in those countless times in the past. So yeah, the number of humans is increasing, which is actually good because human rebirth is very favorable. But that means those consciousnesses are coming out of some other realm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay.
And when you're talking about the mind separating from the body,
mm-hmm.
And the Buddhists like the Dalai Lama, you know, when they pass, these enlightened beings, their consciousness separates from their body and then they go into the bardo and then they will have the choice of going into
yeah.
another
mm-hmm.
person and they pick that person.
Yeah, it's a very controlled process.
So that's the ultimate of...
Yeah. For us, going into the bardo is... Absolutely, they say it's absolutely terrifying, and it's uncontrolled, and we're not thinking rationally. So that's why in the Course on Death and Dying, we'll practice that meditation on going through the death process, so we'll be familiar with it. That's the one His Holiness does four times a day, supposedly. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. So this is the five aggregates. It's one of the lists that Tibetan Buddhism is famous for. Now I'm getting ready to hit you with one of the really good lists. So if this, we say this model is too simple. We want to refine this some more. Okay, we can look at down here what's called mental formations. And we'll be talking about this in 2 weeks. The Buddha says if you want to get a little bit more complicated, you can look at this model called mind and mental factors. And if we look at the mental formations, there are actually 52 main ones. 52, or referred to in that model, as 52 mental factors. And this will be the subject of the class 2 weeks from tonight. This is in the model known as mind and mental factors. Again, it's just explaining in more detail how our mind works and what its qualities are. This is what we have to look forward to. We'll do all 52, and you'll be expected to memorize them. Okay. So we'll go from 5 aggregates to 52 mental factors in 2 weeks. So just what, again, this model does not contradict this. This model does not contradict the very simple model of mind and body. It's just elaborating on it, explaining in more detail.
Can you just give an example of one of the 52?
Well, emotions like anger are, okay. Perseverance is one. Some of them are very hard to explain and I don't understand, okay. But they can be emotions, volition. They're generally volitional things. They're things that we would refer to under that. Category of volition, things that cause us to act, motivating factors. Okay? So I said we were going to do a lot of meditation tonight, and I lied once again. I thought we'd have more time for that. Well, I'll leave that up. I think we're through with that. Any more comments on this before we do another meditation? What we talked about? Okay. So we've got the four qualities of mind, we've got the 5 aggregates, and then we're going to get to the 52 mental factors in 2 weeks. Okay. So, let's do another meditation. We'll do a little bit longer one, and this will be an analytic meditation, the two main types of meditation in Tibetan Buddhism being concentration. The placing the mind on the breath is a concentration meditation where we have a chosen object and we just come back to it over and over and over again. The breath being a very simple object, but we can do more elaborate ones, and we may get into that in the very last class. And then we have analytic meditations where we still have a chosen object, but it's a thought or an idea. And we place our mind on that, on a concept, and use our mind's ability to reason and analyze and just chew with it. So we keep our concentration on that concept. And when we notice our mind has wandered from that, when we're thinking about the debate later tonight or whatever, not that anybody here is interested in such mundane events, we set that aside, say, okay, that'll be later, and then we come back to the chosen concept that we're analyzing in a very focused and concentrated way. So this will be an analytic. Well, actually, this is going to be kind of a combination. Yeah, there are, most of them are combinations. Okay, so begin by checking your posture. Starting at the top and working down, identifying any areas of discomfort or stress and addressing those now. And now we'll do the 9-round breathing. 3 breaths through the in and out through the right nostril. 3 breaths in and out through the left nostril. 3 breaths in and out through both nostrils. And now we allow our breathing to return to its normal pattern. And we take a moment and set our motivation, the bodhicitta motivation, for the meditation to follow. And having set our motivation, we now begin with just a couple minutes of concentration on the breath so that our mind becomes more focused, more alert. Mind on the breath, setting aside every other thought that arises, and they will arise, coming back and back and back to the breath. And now we take our awareness away from the breath. We just set that aside. And we take our concentrated, focused mind. And we're just going to pay attention to the non-stop flow of seemingly random thoughts within the empty space of our mind. We hear something. Thought. We remember something from work today. Thought. We have an itch in our foot. Thought. We plan what we're going to have for breakfast tomorrow. Thought. We just label each thought as it arises, let go of it, and observe the next thought arise. Label it thought and drop it. And inevitably something else will arise. There's never a moment in our mind where there is no thought. We may be unaware of them, but there's always thought going on in that empty space. There are always perceptions, awarenesses. So we're just going to watch the flow. Thought after thought. After thought, after thought, not getting caught up in any of them, but just being aware of them and letting go. And now we're going to change our focus a little bit. And we're going to see if, now that we've observed the flow of thoughts, if we can get a sense of the space in which those thoughts arise. So we're looking at what is not thought, the empty space in which the thoughts occur. Sometimes it's said we look at what's in between the thoughts, but if there's really nothing, no space in between, there's always one thought there. So we're looking at what's around the thoughts. And it may be hard to do this. You may just get a very vague sense of it. See if you get a sense of the empty space in which the thoughts arise. Not the thoughts, but the space in which they occur. And you can end your meditation with a brief dedication. Any questions or comments? Can people get a sense of the empty space in which the thoughts were occurring? Comment? Okay, yeah.
To me, the empty space was vast.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And the thoughts were close in my mind.
Yeah.
And the idea occurred to me that in the vastness, I could see the thoughts of Robbie.
Uh-huh.
Around Robbie.
Uh-huh.
But it was a very vast background.
Yeah, it is vast.
Behind the thoughts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay. Okay. Our time is up for this evening. I am not going to be here next week. I have to be out of town. So Aaron will be leading meditation and discussion at the regular time, 7 o'clock next week. And in 2 weeks, we'll zip through the 52 mental factors, followed by tea and cookies as your reward afterwards. And then we'll have the last class. And I'm not quite sure. There'll be a little bit more material we have to get through. So I don't know what else we'll be doing the last night, but it'll be something fun. Okay, so thank you, everyone.